Here we go, folks. Sorry we're a little bit late tonight. We had some technical difficulties, which hopefully have resolved themselves. And you know what? It's a lovely duet we're doing tonight, talking about the movie Trap. I'm here with Mark, the movie man, Krawcheck. I am, of course, Ian Simmons. We both appear on the Spoiler Room podcast every Monday, talking about classic movies and new classics and all sorts of films in between. But tonight we are on the King of Seat podcast, the live stream, the weekly to-do, talking about M. Night Shyamalan's Trap. Why are we here by ourselves? In their infinite wisdom, and I mean that sincerely, the studio decided not to screen this film for critics. So Mark and I are bona fide money-paying public here. We movie over the weekend, and now we're going to talk about it, which I think gives us even more of a right to complain or praise or whatever we want to do with the film. Mark, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. It's already it's Wednesday, but it's already been a week, so you know.
Yeah, it definitely has been a week made even longer by watching Trap. Now, I gotta say, and I may have said this on other podcasts before, so pardon me if I repeat myself, but I saw the trailer for this movie probably a couple of months ago, and I thought it was really cool. Josh Hartnett playing a dad taking his teenage daughter to a pop concert, and he realizes there's a lot of police around, so he gets a very helpful clerk at the arena to tell him, hey, the cops are here to it's all a big setup to catch a serial killer. Turns out Josh Hartnett, spoiler alert, is the serial killer. And so how's he going to get out of it? Awesome. Great premise. Really well put together trailer. And I was on board until the big flashing warning sign of the title card that said an M. Night Shyamalan experience came on the screen. It's like,
M. Night Shyamalan experience. That's one way to put it. It is an experience. And I'm the guy who's usually accused of being a little on the soft side with movies. And this tested me a number of times.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Okay. You've been accused of being soft on movies, Mark. Where do you fall on Shyamalan?
He's hit or miss with me. I think he does better with his films when he's playing it straighter. I liked The Visit. You know, I mean, Unbreakable for me is probably my favorite of his, if anything, just because I was surprised at what type of film it ended up being. I think that was a bigger and a better surprise than Sixth Sense, you know. And when Sixth Sense came out at the time, it's like, oh, wow, you know, duh. You know, you made you feel kind of dumb. And then, he had Unbreakable, which was solid as well. And then The Signs, for most of it, I liked it. But Signs starts showing an issue that he ends up running into a lot with his later movies as well. Like the first two-thirds of Signs, I really enjoyed until he decided to take it to like a scope of a global thing with the aliens. And then that's exactly where it falls apart and you lose your tension with me. I'm like, oh, you know, it was actually like The Village. The Village was a great, straight, creepy film, but then he felt the need to get a bit creative with the ending and the twist. And, you know, then it falls apart from there. I for the most part enjoyed Old. I enjoyed it more than my son did. Of his recent stuff, I really liked The Visit. I didn't mind Glass either until the ending. Again, it's one of those things where like two thirds of his films, he has me in it. I'm like, all right. And then whatever angle or 180 degree turn he wants to take with the film, it just falls apart because it makes very little sense. And that's what the problem I had with Trap was. Just as I was getting into it, just as I was like, okay, I'm digging the concept. You got all the elements here. Josh Hartnett is killing it as this character. I loved his character, his portrayal, his performance. I loved his performance. I'm even digging M. Night's daughter, Salika. She was actually solid in there. This isn't just, you know, he threw her in there because she's his daughter. She, you know, she actually is a very interesting character as well. All these characters are actually very interesting, and the situation and concept's great. There was just every other turn, though, so much glaring, like, and I'm forgiving, but I'm like, yeah, no. I'm like, I'm sorry. It just, there's a belief, and then there's suspension of disbelief, and then you're just like, no, I can't buy that, you know? And you need, for a movie like this and for the tension and the scenes you get, you need the audience to buy in that that person could get away with what they're getting away with, even by the skin of their teeth. And nearly every part where he got away with something, it was so unbelievable that it just, I suddenly was back at square one. It like reset me. It got me good. I'm like tension filled, and all of a sudden, bloop, dial went back to zero.
I'm, you know, it's weird because I didn't feel the tension at all, or I should say I felt more tension in watching the trailer than I did like at any point during the movie. I think part of it is because of those, something you were alluding to, you know, there's a bit of convenience to it. There's all these like weird decisions in terms of the story, that these, you know, kind of twists and turns take. I mean, it's almost like a training video, an extended training video for, you know, internet privacy or something. Like, you know, never give, if you're instructed to, you know, use a password or something, never give it away to a stranger, never divulge too much information to people who don't need to know, that kind of thing. It was so frustrating. There's one scene, I think, that I thought was the way they resolved it was kind of clever. And in order to talk about that, I'm going to have to put on
the spoiler banner.
That's right. Let's see. Oh, also, I just got to pull over for a second. Am I still sounding a bit weird? I know my mic's been kind of hit or miss lately. I don't know if I need to get a new one.
It sounds a little bit distorted. I mean, I can understand you, but there does seem to be a little bit of either interference or something with it.
Like, is it a crackle or is that hot or what? I don't know.
Yeah, kind of like you're talking through a radio a little bit. So it's
interesting.
A little bit hot.
All right. Well, we're gonna muscle on through. Hopefully, this isn't annoying to our viewers, past, present, and future. Past. Okay. So there's a scene where it's the moment from the trailer, and even the bit in the trailer, I think, was the way it was filmed or certainly edited for the commercial, was more effective than what ended up being the final cut in the movie. It's where he's in a fast food restaurant and he sneaks back to the kitchen and there's like the Crisco or whatever, and he dumps it into the fryer and the bottles explode just as one of the workers discovers it. You know, we actually see her in the background when it happens, but she's just kind of standing there and I guess she gets burned. It's very anticlimactic of what we can see, but he swipes an employee apron, makes his way up to the roof. And there's a couple of SWAT people up there, and he asks to see ID. And what he does is he reaches into the apron and pulls out the wallet of the person that he had lifted it from, and the person's ID is in there. I thought that was interesting because I'm like, he's caught, he's had, how's he going to get out of this? And he realizes, well, you know, this belonged to someone. So that was kind of clever. And then he got a chance to use the password that he had, you know, just basically asked for earlier. So that was, you know, that was a payoff. But because I didn't look at my watch during this movie, I assumed that by the time he and his daughter smuggled themselves out of the concert venue, that the movie was almost over. But there was still 45 minutes left.
Oh, was it that long? It was at least 40. I was thinking 20 or 25. That like a whole, there was a whole nother 20 some odd minutes after.
At the very least, because I mean the concert is half the movie. And yeah, it's one of those things where I was, you know, a lot of people have flashbacks, well, like Usual Suspects or The Sixth Sense or whatever, where you get the big reveal at the end and then it causes you to flash back and think about what you missed. watching Trap after they left the concert venue and were in the limousine with Lady Raven, because she's the pop star that is a main presence in the film, but she's not really a character. You know, it's kind of like we're going to set the movie at a Taylor Swift concert or something, and she's just the talent up on stage. When we're in the limousine and she starts getting real scenes and real acting with Josh Hartnett, and it keeps going on, I'm like, that's right, she did get like third billing in this movie. And then they show back up at Josh Hartnett's character Cooper's house, and we meet his wife. I'm like, oh, that's right, Allison Pill, she was in the credits in the opening. I'm like, that's odd that they would give someone a credit in the opening of the movie for a scene that surely can only be 5 minutes long because we're at the end. No, there are, I think, six movies rolled into this one, and none of them are good.
Yeah, I see the problem I had with the stuff at the, and I know what he was going for. Okay, folks, before anything, I know what he was going for, and he was going for like almost this whole movie is the any common person could possibly be a dark killer, serial killer, you know, that has someone tied up in an abandoned home. Okay, I know what he's going for. That was kind of what he was going for with this. I get that theme, and the elements are here, but yeah, there's a moment where there's someone who's drunk and she's tipsy at the top of the stairs. And I don't care who you are with as many eyes on it. He just walks up behind her and she falls, and he goes, oh, she must have been too drunk. I'm like, dude, you were right there. Nobody at all suspected you. And that was, you know, what was the point of that? You know, there are enough cops out there. You're not going to distract enough of them for you to try to sneak out. And the concert hasn't even started. Then there's this scene. There's a scene where he had stolen the buddy's card, the guy who tells him too much, which I almost thought this was going to be another M. Night superhero film where his ability is he gets people to tell him too much, because at every turn, the dialogue in here, people are telling him too much. The dialogue was rough. But so the cops, the SWAT team, are looking for a middle-aged white guy, so tall, you know, these features, probably looks very conspicuous. They're giving this briefing. A guy who matches that description, wearing nothing but the apron, but he's not wearing any other work clothes. He's literally wearing his LL Bean sweater and blue jeans, literally walks through the group of SWAT team, and they're like, oh yeah. When the guy's describing him, and while it does, don't get me wrong, it does make for an interesting potentially tension-filled scene, because you're waiting for someone maybe to recognize him. At the same point, you're like, this is a killer. They've put all these resources in. They're pulling random guys who look very similar to him from the audience. This guy shows up into their group and no one bats an eye to him, literally asking him for sugar at one point. And I'm sitting here going, really? And that was the problem I had with this, is there were parts where he was doing smart things. I'm like, awesome, great, cool. And then it turned, and he would do something that just made me go, really? Yeah, you know, and that was the problem I had just as I was getting into it, going, okay, we're rolling now. Then you go, I mean, the Friar scene, I'm not trying to rant, but the Friar scene, she had a chance to walk away from that the minute she saw the bottles in the grease. Okay, I've worked fry duty. In fact, she sees the bottle crack. She could have jumped away before it blew. Okay, but not only that, this guy, and while I know they're busy, manages to get in there, and I could see if he just turned the oil up. When he just turned the oil up, I'm like, oh, okay, there you go. And then she looks inside, she sees two bottles. I'm like, oh, come on. Because he would have had to grab two very large oil bottles, somewhat try to be inconspicuous, and dump them in the fry vat. and there's a grill guy right there who, you know what I mean?
Who wouldn't have recognized him as working there. Yeah.
And that was the thing. Well, and at that point, he wasn't even in an apron when he snuck back there to put the stuff in the fry vat.
That's right, yeah.
He was still literally in his plain clothes. And that's the problem I have, is it's trying really hard to be this very creative and interesting, you know, thriller where he's trying to be cunning. But the only reason he's being cunning is because every single law enforcement and person in here is doing something that's not real world. Okay, I'm sorry, but someone would have noticed him grab two of the big bottles. Just turn the dial up on the grease and leave, no problem. Throwing two bottles into that fry vat without anybody hearing him dump the fry, without any. And there were so many moments like that throughout that made me go, I get some people are clueless or indescript some of the time, but the sheer amount of times it happens within this movie just made it more and more unbelievable as you went along. You know, even when we get into the end with the limo and he traps her in the limo and he sneaks out in the plain clothes, that made really little sense.
Well, especially because Lady Raven was also outside that limo, and she didn't get mobbed nearly to the degree that you would expect if Taylor Swift was like standing next to a limo. Like, people were just kind of like standing around her, kind of chill.
She not only didn't get mobbed, but she didn't yell out, "Hey, my driver's actually a kidnapper or killer or something," or give some. She just nonchalantly walked out as if she was going to get a bagel.
Well, look, Mark, I told you this story the other night on your show, The Spoiler Room, which people should definitely check out live every Monday, 9:30 Central PM. In terms of the, you know, cluelessness, the gullibility, the stupidity of, you know, average people, you know, sometimes movies test my patience and strain my credulity. But in my screening of Trap, I had an eye-opening moment, and it was surrounding that scene that you described of the drunk girl on the stairs, and he goes and knocks her down and makes it look like an accident. The police or whoever, they go over to help her, and they say, someone says, "Oh, she fell down the stairs." The couple behind me, the lady said, "No, he pushed her down the stairs." I'm like, yeah. Yeah. So I end up getting up and moving about three rows up from them because they wouldn't stop talking. And everything they were saying was like beyond belief. I just wanted to interview them afterwards and be like, "Is this your first film? And if so, what was that like? This is really amazing." Oh, my goodness. Yeah. But here's the other thing is there was a line that I think was in the trailer that wasn't in the film. Mm-hmm. And I think they should have left it in because it implies that there's an entire scene, but it's like he's talking about, it's like an inner monologue where he's saying, "I can't stop, but I have to kill, I have to do this," which could explain why he's being so reckless. You know, it's not just about him trying to get out, it's about him trying to get out while also giving in to these urges, or he doesn't even necessarily try. It's just something, it's almost like breathing to him. It's so natural. I mean, we established that he's a firefighter, which is weird because that's his cover story, but it turns out he actually is a firefighter in his day life, and he's got a wife and two kids. I want to know more about this story. And it brought to mind the possibility of, I mean, I guess they kind of did it in Backdraft, but the idea of a firefighter who's a serial killer, because you go into these burning houses, and what if you just actively don't save people? You just, you know, throw them into the flames. And maybe he did, who knows? But his whole thing was he chopped people up, and I don't even think there was a gimmick with, like, you see the fire axe or something. It's just like,
no gimmick. He just chopped the killer chopped people up. 12 people at this point, I believe, in I think it was 12. I forgot what number it was.
I think it was, yeah.
Yeah.
12 or 13.
Yeah. 12 or 13 at this point with his like 13th victim in the basement or whatnot. And yeah, it was, that's the thing is, they, all the elements are there. An interesting villain. He's got an interesting double life going on. Using his fireman ability to know which houses are fire traps and are abandoned, so he uses those. You know, and I'm like, okay, this is all interesting, meaty stuff, but everything surrounding it, just, it was like, well, like his wife, because yeah, there are like four movies in here. So after there's one scene in here where I really enjoyed, and I wish there were more moments like that, was he had someone drop to him, because again, this dialogue is not really good. Someone talked to him, go, oh yeah, well, you can't get out anywhere but through the backstage, but only people with backstage passes or whatnot are allowed back there. Like, literally, like you're playing a Lucasfilm old adventure game, and it says, which piece of dialogue? Oh, I must do this now. You know, and every step of the way, they do that. There's later on the scene where the lady goes, oh, yeah, you're going to have to go down this exit, and there's a checkpoint there where you talk to the cops. The only people who don't get to talk to the cops are if you're a member of Lady Raven's staff or group. And I'm like, nobody would just drop that with the security issue. Part that I did like was where he, once he found out about going backstage, he convinced, it was M. Night's Alfred Hitchcock moment where he does his cameo. He tells a very interesting story to play on the heartstrings of the guy looking for someone, because Lady Raven calls one of her fans up to the stage. They dance and then they get to go backstage. So he manages to use his cunning to spin a tale about his daughter beating cancer. And this is this concert. She wanted to really make it. Not telling the guy, please pick us, but setting it up so the guy most likely would pick her. I liked that moment, you know, because that showed he was smart. He wasn't bumbling or being very obvious. And at the same time, it was effective. But everything else, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I was just like,
I cut you off before you got to talk about your favorite moment. And I like that bit too, because the guy turned out to be, it was like one of her, you know, stage managers, but it was also her uncle,
right?
Which was kind of interesting. And he was able to play on the, you know, that familial angle. But what I was going to say, and I think it ties into this scene, is, you know, I think if Josh Hartnett had, I think he does really well in the film, given mm-hmm. what he's asked to do.
Right.
I just don't agree with what he's asked to do for half the performance. When he's in sinister serial killer mode, he's great. Like mm-hmm. the scene backstage where he goes to talk to Lady Raven and, you know, starts talking about, you know, carbon monoxide and its effects. And he kind of throws her off guard and then basically says, I've got this hostage. If you don't give me what I want, I'm going to kill him and you'll be responsible. That's on point. What I don't like is him as a dad. I like his energy. I like that he really appears to care for his daughter, but he's got this G. Willikers, parody of a suburban father that serial killers are supposed to blend in. They're supposed to be nondescript, boring, everyday people. This guy's a freak. Like when he's talking to the mom of one of his daughter's, like, you know, click rivals or something, and they have this whole exchange. The mom was pretty good. She dials it up when she needs to, because she goes from that kind of like nice, sweet, you know, school mom to, no, you're going to, you know, listen to me and, you know, we're going to get our kids together. And I don't like this evasiveness. That's kind of cool. But he's still like, oh yeah, that would be great. But you know, you hurt my daughter's feelings. You know, he's a little bit too crazy. I think if he'd been more subdued, then a lot of what happened to this movie would have been a lot easier to swallow. Mm-hmm. Him moving through those cops to get to the coffee or whatever it is, I think would have been better if he had just been like someone that you wouldn't notice. Kind of like what Christopher Reeve did when he transformed from, you know, Superman to Clark Kent just by kind of adjusting his posture. You see him change in front of you and you believe it. You know, this giant 6-foot tall guy with all these muscles under this suit, in an instant you believe, oh yeah, I would pass him in the street and never think a second thought. The other issue, and I just found out that it was all in my head. Let's see, what's the actress's name? Ariel Donahue, who plays Riley, Cooper's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
It bugged the crap out of me because for the first half of the movie, I thought, she looks like she's 25 years old. She does not look like a teenager. Mark, I looked up on IMDb. She was born in 2010, which means she was probably like 13 when they made this movie. I'm like, wow. I don't know if it's something in the water, but she just looks like, you know, much older. And she just like also carries herself like she's older. It's weird because, or maybe it's just me. It's a function of age. Maybe it's that I think people who are, you know, actually 14 should look like they're six or something. But like, I didn't buy it. She looked too old to be at that concert. And the girls who played her friends, we get a glimpse of them. They look much younger than she did. So, yeah. And she also, she's so integral to the story in the first half during the concert part that when we leave the concert, it becomes about Lady Raven and her attempts to survive and foil Cooper's, you know, plans. And then when Riley shows back up, at, you know, towards the end of the movie, I'm like, oh, that's right. She was in this and she was kind of important an hour ago. What's going on here?
Yeah. And I didn't mind that change. I thought that was interesting how it changed to him just trying to get out to him kind of, you know, using Lady Raven and then finding a potential new victim in the form of Lady Raven. And I actually liked and those were the moments that I really liked. I liked the back and forth. I liked that Lady Raven had some wits about her. She wasn't just, oh no, he's going to kill her. You know, she was thinking, like when Riley's on the phone with her mom, because they were just going to be dropped off by near his car, she's like, oh no, hey Riley, let's go to your house, I'd love to be, you know, we could take you all the way home. And he's so devout to his daughter that he doesn't want to say, well, don't, you know. And and so I liked the cat and mouse bits. So when they leave the stadium and you get those that back and forth between Raven and Cooper, I loved those moments. I thought that was some of the stronger moments in this film.
Yeah.
Because Lady, and that's where I believe her first name Salika, that's where I was impressed with her acting with Hartnett, because there's a wonderful, like, you know, back and forth tension scene, and then she uses her popularity to help narrow down where they're holding, you know, Cooper's possible next victim. I love that whole section of like 10 minutes there, where from when they leave to when she's in the bathroom doing the social media thing to try to save the guy. Loved that whole sequence. I'm like, but that was like a different movie than what we got into in the beginning and then what we get into at the end.
It is. And I think my problem with, because I like that idea in concept, she essentially jumps on, you know, an Instagram live and says, hey, I'm trapped in this bathroom, but, you know, you guys can help me save the life of this guy who's trapped in a basement. You know, anyone in the Philadelphia area, if you live near a broken lion statue and there's a house with a blue door and all this other stuff, great stuff. However, it reminded me of the problem I had with the climax of Shaun of the Dead, where everybody is locked in the Winchester and there's a, you know, a city's worth of zombies trying to break in.
Sure.
And what we stop for 10 minutes to have this family drama about Sean's mom turning into a zombie and I don't want to kill her. And I was like, weren't there people like literally breaking down the walls like a minute ago? I got the same energy here. It doesn't help. I understand what Shyamalan was doing, but the fact that we're in the bathroom with Raven the entire time, we hear commotion on the other side of the door, but I really wanted to know what was going on there, because he ended up just like sending his family upstairs. Yeah. And then he, you know, she opens the door, right?
Yeah.
I think he doesn't break it down or anything, but
no,
I feel like if he was that desperate, he would have broken the door down. I don't know. I wasn't quite sure. It felt like it was a written moment rather than an authentic moment. And it just, I was so wrapped up in why am I not connecting with this scene that I couldn't connect with the scene.
Well, and she, as my oldest son really had some issues with it, because he's like, she could have gone out the window. I mean, the window right there, she would have been able to fit and gone through the window out there, because that's on the first floor too. I mean, she would have, you know, been able to get out there and get back to her vehicle where her driver was and say, let's get the hell out of here. That's one of the many moments, again, where, yes, he's cunning and he's scary and that, but it helps that the world around him is like completely just written, as you said, not necessarily realistic. It's written for this rather than trying to be somewhat believable, like, oh, I could see how he got away with this. And then you're just like, well, no, he's got the plot armor so thick that he could do these things. And it's like, in this day and age, now, if this was made, say, 15 years ago, or maybe 20 years ago, when security and things and all of that, it was a different kind of approach, I maybe could have believed it more. But if with it being set in modern age and how security things are, and sometimes over secure, you know, all a step of the way, it was just tough. And it's even further, you know, with this whole bathroom scene, she had the phone with the remote, would have had the remote to where he could kill his victim, throw the phone in the toilet. He can't control it.
Yeah.
Or smash the phone.
Smash it with the lid of the toilet or something like that. Yeah.
Smash the phone. Smartphones aren't, he didn't have any like OtterBox on it or anything. You literally could have, you know what I mean? And that was the thing. There were a lot of things, especially with the somewhat M. Night twist to this, because we do still get of a somewhat end twist with this, with the wife, because after he's failed to kidnap Raven, he gets in his he does a very quick change, I mean literal quick change, manages to get out of a limo with a bunch of group of people around, not noticing that this common guy, not a driver, gets out of the limo. Anyway, makes it back to his house, and he confronts his wife, because he figures, okay, somehow the cops found out, so it's got to be possibly with my wife. And then then it comes out that, yes, she's the one that suspected, because he was acting all suspicious. She thought maybe he was cheating on her. And here's the thing. And this was the thing that got my son, and it got me too, and I really wish they hadn't put it in there, is she went to one of the empty houses that he was using for his kill victims. All that was in there was a chair and a laptop, but he dropped the receipt for the concert. Now, here's the thing. It was a full receipt, and she tips off the cops that this could be his hideout, but only left a part of a receipt there, she said. She literally said she tore part of the receipt to leave it there as if it was an afterthought and not planted. And I'm sitting there going, you know, just, you have evidence. Why the elaborate? Just have the cops go get him for questioning.
Well, on top of that, and I didn't even think about that until you were just mentioning that connection. Why, if you suspect that your husband might be the butcher, the local serial killer, would you ever let him take his daughter to a concert? Why wouldn't you just say, you know, oh, daddy's gone off to work at the firehouse. We're going to go on a trip to my parents, to grandma's, and just like get the hell out of there and then call the cops. I mean, there's this whole ending thing where she ends up like, what? This is something else I didn't figure out, because I was half like zoned out at this point. But they sit down to have one last piece of pie together. She poisoned the pie. She slipped him a Mickey, basically. But she ate a piece of that same pie. I could have sworn I saw her take at least one bite of it. Because he says, you know, I'll have mine finished in 5 bites or whatever. So this isn't going to buy you much time.
There was already powdered sugar on it. And the Mickey stuff that he used for his victims was also white. So she put it on his. So there was powdered sugar on both of them. That's why he didn't notice. It was very brief, though. You barely get a shot of the cake when she takes it off. But there's already... a coating on there. The coating that was on there masked the powder she had on it already.
Right, but I'm saying that they both ate from the same.
Right, but she didn't pour it on hers, just his. But
I got it. Okay.
See, there was powdered sugar on both, and then she took extra powder and put it on top of his. But at least that's what I think. That's what I pictured. Figured it out. But not only that, but as my son pointed out, she's having this conversation over pie, and you get this scene where he's been having visions of his mom. Okay, because he's got mommy issues. Of all the things we play at with our villain, what is the common thing they do with male villains? Oh, he's got mommy issues. I'm like, really? We fall back to that?
They even at one point, I think Salika figures this out, and she does the whole thing like, Jason, mother is talking to you.
Yeah.
You
know, kind of she tries to play that angle with it. But so then you have this supposed cracked FBI profiler who this guy's having illusions. He's all drugged up. He sees her silhouette. He thinks maybe his mom. He drifts into the dining room and they taser the shit out of him. Now, here's my point for my oldest son was those cops were sitting there for a while. This literally is most likely the butcher, yet they just sat there and let him have a conversation over pie before they went in. Like, eight guys come in and actually tackle his ass and arrest him. No, we do this whole pie scene. He gets the drug thing. He has the hallucination thing. And then they taser him with like eight tasers before he goes down. And I'm like, really?
they needed to have at least some kind of a beat where before they move in, she talks about like, I just needed to hear you say it, because then you could at least say they couldn't do anything because they needed a confession. They didn't quite have enough evidence, which I mean, at this point they have to know. even if they just, you know, move in quietly, you don't have to tase them, just like handcuff them or something. But I agree. And then this movie turns into that glass splintered Shyamalan thing, because he's tasered like four times and he's still hulking out and like he's shirtless wearing jeans. I don't even know if he had shoes on at this point, but he's like tackling cops in full tactical gear. I'm like, no, this is not happening.
Yeah. And then as they're carrying him out in cuffs, a bike falls, because the whole thing is that he's also OCD. So the girl's bike falls and they let him go over to the bike and put the bike up. I'm like, this is a guy who has killed. And again, it's these moments, these decisions that these law enforcers and the crack FBI profile, everything, these decisions that they make are the dumbest decisions that are solely there for our villain to do something rather than feel like a natural progression of events that would happen, you know. And again, Salika, I enjoyed everybody's performances in here. I enjoyed the characters and the setup. It was the story itself, the screenplay, that really needed some tailoring and polish. And it would have been great even if they would have held it just to the arena, you know, for most of it, to where he's constantly trying to dodge or avoid the law enforcement, not walk in front of them, be all Mr. Confident. You know, I think there was something compelling there. It was just very sloppily done.
You know, I mentioned Taylor Swift earlier, and I think it would have been, I don't know how you would do this, but especially because she's got a very young fan base, and I think this would have been seen as a little bit too edgy even for the Swifties. But I imagined a version of this film where, as much as I enjoyed, you know, Salika Shyamalan, what if, you know, the Eras Tour, the big concert movie that Swift did last year, imagine doing, like, setting this up as a legitimate Taylor Swift concert movie, but you've got the behind the scenes stuff, but then you drop this serial killer story into it, and then it just takes this crazy turn. It's kind of like the do you remember the teaser trailer for that Wes Craven movie Red Eye? It's Cillian Murphy and Rachel McAdams, just like, oh, a meet cute on the plane, but then it like does that close up of his eye, like, oh shit, this is a horror movie. It's something like that, a nice classic rug pull. But we didn't get that.
No.
The bike thing. he is in the back of the SWAT van, and he does the thing where he's hidden the pin or something.
Yeah, a spoke from the bike.
Right.
He manages, with the four cops standing right there, he manages to snap off a spoke cunningly and slide it into his sleeve, I think it is. Yeah, the sleeve of his sweater, this wonderful sweater that he... Well, no, that's right. He was... No, he had his shirt on at that point.
Yeah, yeah, sure. They gave him his shirt back.
They gave him his shirt, so he slid it in the sleeve of his shirt so that he could pick the lock at the very end. And I'm just like, you're in an armored vehicle. Okay, you took the handcuffs off. Every other situation we've ever seen them open for the serial killer to come out the doors, there's a line of like SWAT to for him to walk through. And
especially because it's not like they're going to stop at Quickie Mart and let him out. They're going to let him out in like the garage of a police station or something, right? He's not getting out. But yeah, like that is the big question that I had is like, okay, what's next? I mean, I think he's trying to end on kind of like a psycho moment where Norman Bates is in the padded cell and it turns out he's really not cured after all, but it just doesn't work here. But yeah, the thing about the spoke is he pulls it out of his mouth from under his tongue or whatever, or was it, I couldn't remember. Was it his
I think
sleeve?
It was in his sleeve.
It was okay. Okay.
Yeah, it was in his sleeve.
But still, like how long is I would want to go back and watch that scene because it seemed like it happened very quickly. And I don't know if you can like just maneuver that even to just think about it. It was a little bit too instant. Maybe it's because we're meant to see this guy as a supervillain and a super genius. Cause that's the only way he's getting out of that SWAT truck situation is if they open up the door at the end and he hulks out again and just like takes on a bunch of dudes and runs off.
And I think you used the word properly, instant. There are so many instant moments with this guy that I, again, thought maybe we were leading to another like Unbreakable type situation, Glass situation in that same world, which I would have, in all honesty, if we would have taken that angle with it, I almost would have been better with that if he had some kind of, you know, ability, because in, you know, the Unbreakable world, you have more of these subtle abilities that aren't like super suit abilities, but people still have right. All these different. I would have loved that he somehow is like the chameleon of sorts, to where he is able to, you know, without being observed, change costumes instantly, because he gets in full SWAT fairly quickly as well. When he takes the tunnel he dug to the neighbors, nobody watched whatever door he came out of his neighbors, you know, and again, that was it. Those were so many of those. Everybody was clueless of what he did. Oh, look how cunning. I'm like, yeah, there's not being observed. And then there are some of the things he does. And it's just, I couldn't get over it. I really did. Every step of the way, I was like, I'm into this. Okay, I'm going to give that to you. Let's go. What do you got for me now? And then he does something else that just was so glaring that you're
it is. Like, it goes back to that whole serial killer thing. This movie needed to just blend in to get the audience on a wavelength and take us on a journey and then do the rug pull. That's one of the things that makes The Sixth Sense so great, is it is a ghost story. It's a, you know, a broken little boy story, you know, getting help from this kind of older mentor guy. And you know, a lot of people, I know so many people in the last quarter century, like, I knew it all along, or I knew it the moment she slid the check away from. I saw The Sixth Sense at an early screening, like a week before it came out, and all anybody knew about it, what it was, it wasn't M. Night Shyamalan, because he only done, I think, one movie before that, like Awakenings or something. Mm-hmm. All it was it's the new Bruce Willis movie, and he's like, it's a ghost story. So no one had any expectation of it. I didn't either. I got like an advanced screen ticket with a friend of mine, and we went and we came out just like completely jaws on the floor, flabbergasted, not Same just here. Because of the twist, but because it's a really great, well shot, well acted, well, very tightly written ghost story. That's kind of lovely. Whereas this movie, everything is conspicuous. You're questioning everybody's motives and moves and actions, and what is he doing here? What's she doing here? Haley Mills playing the FBI profiler, I thought was kind of interesting, but she barely has any scenes. She's a peripheral character. She should have been front and center. And to your point, Mark, about connecting this to other Shyamalan films, I find that kind of cheesy, but wouldn't it have been great if they had a scene in her office or at least her command center where she's like just leafing through the profiles of the people that she's tackled, looking for, you know, an insight into what Cooper might do next. Yeah. And you just pass a picture of James McAvoy, in one of those files. Don't mention it. Just like it's an Easter egg, you know?
But yeah. And there could have been a number of other moments or, you know, when they drop the name of a FBI profiler, and it was Haley Mills. I'm like, okay, now we're going to get kind of a fugitive type of situation. I'm here for it because you've got smart profiler and smart, you know, villain. Let's see where this goes. Unfortunately, she's in the periphery for most of this. We barely get to spend time with her. And I realize he's trying to tell the whole movie from the perspective of the serial killer. I mean, that's what he's going for. You don't leave Josh Hartnett's side. You don't leave Cooper's side really for any of this because he wants
to tell the bathroom scene.
He wants you to you know, be over the shoulder of this guy, and I get that, but at the same time I'm like, if it would have been approached a little bit differently, I think there's a very interesting cat and mouse between, because that would have been great, first a cat and mouse between him and the profiler, and then he manages to get one up on the profiler and they get out of the stadium, and then you move to the cat and mouse between him and, you know, Lady Raven, to where showing where he's being challenged every step of the way by these individuals who are at least using their brain for the most part, you know. I think that would have been compelling, but we don't get that in here. You know, they've got cameras all over. They're reviewing footage, but you're telling me they don't notice some guy who's creepily looking around the corner directly at the camera? Like he's not even that subtle about it. He literally kind of just does this. And I'm like, that's on camera. They got all these eyes on all these monitors, and no one notices, hey, that guy who has the description of the guys we're looking for is creepily looking around the corner at our camera directly. He's looking a little sus. Maybe we should track him down.
Yeah, I mean, like, there weren't nearly enough deaths in this movie. I mean, because I think about, there's the one SWAT guy that is suspicious of him when M. Night Shyamalan tries to, you know, get him into the backstage area or something like that. The one guy is like looking at him like, are you sure about this? Mm-hmm. What needed to happen was, I think you stay in the concert the entire time, but you got Josh Hartnett running around just like killing everybody who ends up suspicious of him. Take out the mom. You find a way to get that SWAT guy alone. And then there's a big John Wick style fight. And we know from the climax that Cooper could take him because he's apparently a mutant. But yeah, just do that. David Wilt had a comment earlier, and we're going to pull over and do comments real quick.
Sure.
The movie kind of feels like a reversal of the 80s classic Die Hard, where instead it is the villain who's trapped inside the building with the good guys guarding it. I was thinking about that, like having to fight your way out of the building to escape because you're, you know, the villain. I think that's right. That's a really interesting take and kind of what I was hoping to see with this movie. David also says, I think that what makes M. Night Shyamalan such a unique director is his plot twist, because in the movie Unbreakable, which takes a dark turn on many superhero movies, you don't realize the character Elijah Price is a villain because he doesn't have a sinister lair and he has no army. Yeah, I didn't like Unbreakable the first time I watched it, but I revisited it a few years ago and it's still kind of wonky at the end. I don't love that they resolve that whole thing by saying, you know, Bruce Willis's character and Elijah, like they went on to fight and all this other stuff. I'm like, no, you show that stuff. That's, you know, I don't know if he knew that he was going to make other movies involving these characters, but it just seemed like a cop out.
We talked a bit about it. I've talked about it for a long time with M. Night. M. Night unfortunately got the double-edged sword. He came out of the gate. His second feature was a mass hit. Everybody loved it because he had the twist. And I think, you know, he had that one really planned out and Unbreakable planned out with a twist. And those two are really solid. And even with Signs, you get a bit of this twist, though. That is like the cops letting Cooper around. Oh, these aliens who get killed by water are taking over a planet that's 80% water. That twist, it just it's like, again, really?
And they're walking around without spacesuits of any kind.
And they're walking around without some kind of protection from said water. You know, so, but it almost feels like he felt the need to have a twist. It's why I like The Visit, actually, quite a bit of his more recent, and even Cabin in the Wood, A Knock at the Cabin. I like those two films because those are handled a bit straighter. They don't really have the M. Night Sixth Sense twist. They have a little bit of an angle, but not much. And I like the way those stories play out better because there's nothing wrong with them. He doesn't have to do a twist every time. But I feel like since Sixth Sense and Unbreakable were huge, he feels like, oh, this is the thing I'm known for now. I'm going to have to put in it. And then you get something like The Village, which you're like, oh, this is great. Creepy guys in costumes. And no, it's actually the conservative leaders trying to just keep people in the village from leaving. And then, oh, wait, really? They bought the airspace around the park so no planes could get
fly. You know, here's the thing, Mark. I've never seen The Village.
Oh.
Because I heard so many, like, not even bad things about it, but just kind of like what you're saying. It's great up to a point and then it's not. And I just didn't want to be disappointed like that. And I think that's what's kept me from, you know, Shyamalan has become very hit and miss. So every once in a while, I'll dip my toe back into one of his movies. And I'm like, yeah, it's still kind of, it's like the end of almost any Stephen King movie. It's great, but he can't end it to save his life anymore. Let's see. David also says this movie also has classic movie actress Haley Mills appearing in a thriller since she was known and appearing in many family shows and movies. What struck me is that she reminded me in appearance, and this is no knock against her, it's just something that I thought of Malcolm McDowell in Rob Zombie's Halloween.
a little bit.
She striking resemblance and like, and the British, you know, elderly person pursuing the serial killer. I'm like, get those two together. Imagine if they had, this might have come off really stupid, but what if the twist was, because we keep flashing to Cooper having visions of his mother, and we see an actress very clearly, but what if we had only seen her sort of either in silhouette or in like bathed in light like we did in that last scene, and it turns out that the mom is actually the profiler who's pursuing her son who turned out to be a serial killer.
You know, I would have been fine with it, in all honesty, with the way the rest of some of the film, I would have been fine with it because, again, it's kind of a rug pull because it's bucking expectations. But at the same time, you can go, okay, in this world, I can kind of buy that. The whole thing with Sixth Sense is everybody gets fooled by previous movie experience, because the big hook, where the big turning point in that film is we go from Bruce Willis in his house to we get a scene with him on the bench that says 6 months later, and he meets a kid who can see dead people. But since you establish this establishing shot of just him on a bench 6 months later, you're like, oh, whatever happened before, he survived and he's here. And they never address it because the kid who is so used to seeing dead people just takes him as a guy and is fine talking to him. He's not bothered by it. So there's no indication, but just putting the six months later tag on it, everybody's brain moves into a separate part with the storytelling. And, you know, even with Unbreakable had the same thing to where, oh, wait a minute. He's got a superpower. You know, it's like, but you edge into it. And it pulls your expectation of, oh, this isn't a thriller about this. This is a guy who actually is, oh, wait, this is an actual comic book movie.
Right. And, you know, the thing about The Sixth Sense, you're absolutely right. But it's also supported by these other little clever things where after that incident, he still has scenes with his wife. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, at the dinner table and other moments, it's not until you think back on those, on everything else in the film, like, oh, that's right, no one was actually interacting with him, or he was out in public, so it looked like he was kind of having conversations, but he really wasn't if you go back and pay attention. And that's what this movie was missing. I mean, what if you know, this film had been told from Riley's perspective,
right?
And it turns, like, she discovers that her dad is the killer. I mean, that would have been, I think, great, because going into this movie, you either have to play it like the Die Hard thing, where it's all about his struggle to get out and not get caught, and maybe not let his daughter know that he's a killer at all. I was waiting for that to be the twist, like maybe they're in on it together.
See, that's what I thought it was going to be, you know.
Or maybe he's covering for her, like she's the one who's actually killing people, and he's just like, he's almost like the familiar to the vampire. Or you go to the approach of, they're in a concert, she's there to watch her favorite pop star, but oh, there's all these cops there because there's a serial killer in the venue. And then at the end, it turns out it's the dad.
Right.
Like, we see all these, almost like a giallo film, we see these murders happen. You don't know who's doing it, but it turns out it's our heroine's father.
Mm-hmm.
Something. I know we're doing a thing where we rewrite the movie, but when we spend an hour and 45 minutes watching this, you can't help, I think, especially if you love movies and you talk movies all the time, but consider the other possibilities and just wonder, is this really Shyamalan doing the best he thinks he can do? Because I'm not so sure that it is. I'm not sure what's in his head.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is I'm not sure either, because I've enjoyed a lot of the things with it, but there were some things that just, some decisions that just could have been tweaked to really keep this a compelling story, to not have such glaring questions that come out at you. And maybe it's because we're older and we've seen so many movies that these things just naturally come, and say, you know, someone who may have not watched as many of these films may have been really into it and just not questioning it. But you know, for me, for a film like this, the appeal is, how does he get away from a situation that you could possibly see being in real life, not just a movie? It doesn't have to be completely realistic, but just enough to where you go, wow, this guy, you know, I'm really trying to figure out how to feel it. Where is this going to go? You know, I mean, at one point they have a guest singer shows up, and there's a hole in the floor next to him. And this guy, who is trying to be subtle the whole time, goes, hey, should we go down there? Trying to talk to his daughter. Let's go down there. And she's like, what the fuck's wrong with you, man? She's like, we don't go down there. You know, he's acting not as subtle as he should have been. And again, it was what was getting me with the film, was I'm like, I really wish I could enjoy this more than I could, but there's just too many of these glaring, bad, like lazy decisions made, that if they would have just maybe gone once over and tightened things up a bit, you really could have had something more compelling for me. But in the end, I just had way too many questions and going, what was the decision with this scene, especially the end? Again, okay, he picked the lock out of his handcuffs. He doesn't have split power to where he can Hulk out like McAvoy, you know. So he's not going to like Hulk out and smash through the back of the door of the armored truck. So what's the point of him taking the cuffs off?
I don't know. And there's also it's not even really a mid credit sequence. It's right, you know, almost right after the credits start rolling.
Yeah.
You do the thing where they cut back in. So I guess it's mid credits. But Jonathan Langdon, who played Jamie, the super helpful concert vendor.
I liked him quite a bit.
I liked him too. And, you know, there is some, I guess you could call it, tension of, is Cooper going to murder this guy, right, you know, in the basement and take the T-shirt, which I think if this had been I'll call it a better movie. You know, people might say, yeah, but that's expected. Yes, but sometimes the horror genre, the slasher genre, if it's done really well, can be far more effective than just trying to subvert everything and falling flat on your face, as I think Shyamalan did here. But in the mid-credit sequence, you cut back to Jamie sitting on his couch watching the news, and because he's like the Butcher super fan, which is also kind of creepy. He's got like pictures of the crime scenes on his phone, but he's watching the news and he's like, oh my God, I helped the butcher. And he's like feeling, he's freaking out and he's kind of feeling guilty about it, but it's on a completely comedic note. I'm like, what is this movie?
Well, and that was the issue with I had with that. I loved his character. I thought it was interesting that he was kind of a butcher fan and he's talking to the butcher. He didn't know it. I liked, again, another sequence, like a little pod of sequences in here that I really enjoyed, the interaction of Cooper with this character. So at the end, we play it off comedic that he was helping the serial killer. I'm like, wait, he was a super fan. He would have had a, if he was this super fan that you were kind of angling he was at, I think he would have had a different reaction than, oh, you know, than what he had. You, like you said, instead of comedic, he should have either played it scared or was like, oh, wow, I got to meet him.
Yeah, I mean, you could have ended this on a really kind of a creepy note because it is, even the fact that he's a superman is played for laughs earlier in the film. Mm-hmm. Like, what's up with this guy? Does he, and that's, you could do something with that as a bit of character development. Like, oh, it becomes real for him. It's not just news headlines or, oh, cool body parts on a lawn. It's, these are actual people. And oh my God, I just helped the person unwittingly who kills people. You know, I don't know how you would have worked this, but let's just say because Cooper is now on the lam, let's just say somehow he gets out of that van. What if the mid-credit sequence is, you know, the same thing. Jamie's on his couch and he's watching the news and that he realizes he just helped the butcher. And then there's a knock on the door and it's
Cooper. Then you go to black.
Hey, he's like, hey, buddy. I was wondering if you could help me out. Yeah, cut to black.
Or instead of on the news thing where they say they captured him, he somehow eluded folks, you know, after what did I do, a clip that he's still, you know, he broke out of custody some way. And then you get him shocked that he helped Cooper. And then there's a knock at a door. And then you go to the credits. You don't even show who's the knock at the door. You just go to,
sure,
hey, he, you know, just to give it an illusion like, oh, what's going to happen? You know, at least give a little bit more of a compelling any like, wow, what's going to happen next? Cooper got away. How'd he get away? You know, but.
And what we're talking about in either scenario here is a cliche. You might watch it. And if you're newer to movies, you might, oh, that's kind of cool. But for us seasoned, jaded guys, it's like it's something, it's not out of the realm of possibility. But what it is more effective than what we got during the rest of the movie. I'd rather watch a superbly executed cliche than someone who thinks they're smarter than a movie full of cliches, and they try and subvert those expectations, not understanding that, you know, you don't introduce Coke 2, you stay with Coke 1.
Well, and as much as many critics, you know, and I've even brought it up too, saying, oh, this film uses a lot of tropes, or you get some of these, you know, common archetypes, you get these because they work if they're handled properly. So right. You don't mind they're there, even if it's something that is very familiar, because if it's done and handled well, that's effective. It's a reason why. I mean, you and I, we've been covering films from almost 90 years ago, and they're using tools there that they use today. And the reason they're still using some of those tools in storytelling today is because it works.
Right. And we talked about The Damned Don't Cry on your show a few nights ago, a movie that's almost 75 years old. And it is, you know, I wasn't the biggest fan, mostly because of these kind of screenplay issues that we talked about. But the more I think about it, the more I really do admire the movie. Great performances, great, you know, concept. Even that, a movie that is so old that it's, I mean, you couldn't even get most modern audiences to watch it. There's more going on there, more excitement and more nuance as far as the story goes than there is in all of this movie. It's just frustrating, especially because, as I pointed out, we paid to go see this movie.
I think you hit the nail on the head, nuance. There was nuance in Sixth Sense. There was even nuance in Unbreakable and somewhat in Signs and even some of his other films. It's when he gets to that, oh, pull the rug type, that's where the nuance seems to fly out the window. And in this one, he gives up on nuance early because you know the guy is a serial the serial killer. So, you know, I was even hoping at the very end, the big rug pull was that the wife was actually in on it. So when he goes back to the house and sneaks up on her, you know, we get the camera up on her like you're sneaking up on her. And then she turns around. I was like, oh, I almost wanted to. I'm like, oh, do it. Go. You screwed up again. We had it perfect and you screwed it up again. How many times have I told you you've been getting sloppy? I was hoping for that moment because that, I'm like, that is a twist, but that is something that would work because we don't see enough of the wife. We've seen the pictures of the happy household, and it would help make a little bit more nuance and a big surprise having her suddenly be the one too, that where they're playing, you know, the Bradys or the Beavers, you know, you know, they're and you Warden June, and they're not actually Warden June, you know. And I was hoping for that, but they don't do that either. And I'm like, you had an opportunity even to do that. I wouldn't have minded because it would have given the second, this whole third of the film where we're outside of the stadium, some more meat to it and purpose to it. If she was then in on it as well,
you know, or, you know, like we kind of alluded to earlier, what if the daughter was also, hell, what if the entire family was she? You know, the profiler goes back to the house to make sure everybody's okay. Cooper's been hauled off or something. And, you know, that like all three of them just like attack her. And then it cuts to black as she's screaming for her life.
Or the daughter pulls up the app on her phone and pulls up another guy, or like pulls up, you know, that's in a basement, another victim.
Yes, like they've all got apps with different victims on them. it's the family plan for killers. All right, so like kind of rounding things out here, RJB40, I thought this movie was nepotism at its finest. And now here's the thing, I agree. I not in the way that you're thinking, but as Mark and I have pointed out, you know, Salika Shyamalan does a very good job, you know, in this movie. Did she get the job because her dad is M. Night Shyamalan? Probably, because I know they've worked together before, but I think, you know, in this case, you know, I'm fine with it. If she was terrible, then I'd say, I there's a movie that I watched recently called, oh my gosh, what was it called? Oh, Duchess, mm-hmm. Which I'll be reviewing with David Fowley. We already recorded a review. It'll be coming out on Monday. That is a case of, I guess you could call it nepotism, but it's one where you can watch the flaming car wreck in progress for 2 hours, and it's not fun. You want to talk about nepotism? I can't even talk right now. Trap is not that movie.
No. No.
Let's see. And then Timothy McFerrin asks, rightly, where's Armand? Armand is not on the show tonight, but don't worry. I know the director's cut of Rebel Moon is out, at least for part one. Mark, did they do both parts, or is are they releasing?
No, both parts are out. I've got to watch them yet. I'm probably going to watch them this weekend because I'll have my reviews of the indie screeners I've got done, and I'll actually have a little lull. So I may actually watch something for myself. So I'm going to probably watch Rebel Moon 1 and 2, the R cuts. I didn't watch Rebel 2 Moon Part 2, the PG-13 cut. I just held off and going, yeah, I'm just going to wait for both director's cuts to come out and watch them. Because I do enjoy Zack Snyder's visual things. And I am curious of the difference. So far, I've heard mostly mixed positive towards the positive, mixed reviews of
really?
That it was better than the PG-13 version of the films. But some people still don't like Zach or his style or the film, but I liked the first one. I was intrigued where it was going to go. So yeah, I'm probably going to watch them this weekend though.
You have 6 hours to spare, however long these things are.
Well, yeah, you could pause in between or whatnot, but
yeah, I'm just kidding, because yeah, I didn't know. I had heard that part one was out, but I didn't know if they released both because the Netflix chopped them up for the first, you know, go around. So, in answer to your question, Timothy, if you're still watching, yes, that's on the docket for sometime in the nearest future. I still got to watch the movies and then reach out to Armand and get him on the show. So stay tuned for that. But we're not quite at the runtime of Trap, but we are over time, Mark. Yeah. And I appreciate you hanging out and talking about this this movie with me. I love that we earned the right to complain because we hand over our hard-earned money. And yeah, I don't want to give up on M. Night Shyamalan.
It makes me sad that
he's hit or miss for me, you know?
And I don't either because of that, because he'll have a few misses and then all of a sudden he'll have something like I mentioned Visit or Knock at the Cabin to where I actually find it intriguing and appreciate it. And at the end I go, I enjoyed that. You know, there were maybe some bumps and such, but I thought it was, you know, a very interesting story. You know, I think he doesn't necessarily need to do the full 180 twist for his stories, because as I mentioned, you know, especially those two, The Visit didn't really have it, and neither did Knock at the Cabin, because the ending, what came true was what was promised, you know. So it was one of those to where it wasn't really a rug pull, because what happened was what was supposed to happen.
Well, I haven't seen The Visit or Knock at the Cabin Door. Those were kind of like on the, like, I fall victim to this too. I'll listen to what critics say or people that I know, they're like, eh, and I'm getting old now and I don't want to waste my time. That wasn't a pun about one of his recent movies, by the way, which I did watch. And I'm like, this is why I don't watch all of his movies. I didn't care for it that much, but I'll have to catch with those. But maybe the twist for Knock at the Cabin Door is that there is no twist, huh?
It could be. Dave Bautista got to exercise his acting chops a little bit more. I thought he was great in it, and it is an interesting story. I mean, I'm not saying that it was, you know, oh my God, mind blowing, but at the same time, it was far one of his better films, I thought, overall. And, you know, and I don't like not liking a movie, in all honesty. And I had this debate. Actually, I ended up getting unfriended by someone because I mentioned some criticism of a film. And I'm like, if you like it, great. Just for me, and they said, well, some people just like hating films. And like, I don't like hating films, or I don't like disliking films. Hate is a strong word. There's only one movie right now, maybe two, in the entire pantheon of my viewing that I hated. But dislike,
I know which more. One of them one of them is sitting on a shelf behind me, I know, and I'm gonna turn you around on that someday.
Dislike is more of the proper term. I don't like disliking movies, but you know, sometimes it just happens to where a film won't hit because for however you do come into the film, you know, it just doesn't strike for you. It doesn't hit. There were too many questions and really moments in Trap for me to really get into it, to where I'm like, I wanted to enjoy it more than I did, but by the end I was like, that was only 100 minutes.
Yeah, it was rough. But yeah, just to briefly, I mean, to what you're saying, it's a popular misconception, I think, among critics, because a lot of the reviews tend to be snarky or, you know, enjoying taking the piss, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think part of that is us as critics exorcising that displeasure and trying to make something positive or creative out of the experience. Nobody likes having to sit through 2 hours of something dreadful, and sometimes coming up with a bad review, a negative review, is the only way we can really cope or to justify that time to get it back. I don't like trashing movies. I happen to be spectacularly good at it, but it brings me no joy to do so.
I was going to say, you make a nice art of it. You've got it.
Thank you. No, that's Jeff York. He literally makes an art.
Yes, that's true. He literally makes art. So,
all right, Mark, we're gonna get out of here. I'm gonna let you get back to your Wednesday night. And but thanks again, man. This has been a lot of fun. And one of the reasons I do love doing these shows is because even when the movie is terrible, the art, I think, is the conversation that comes out about it. So I appreciate it, man. Everybody out there, check out Mark's stuff. The Spoiler Room live every Monday. Oh, this coming Monday, it's actually going to be 8:30 p.m. Central, because you're having your 500th episode celebration, sir.
Yes.
I'm going to be there with you talking about Showgirls. I'll
be there with my tassels on. No, anyway, that'll keep people away. So, no, I won't be wearing tassels. So.
Well, I might be. Anyway, check out Mark's stuff down below. Also, all of Earth's Mightiest Critics who were, you know, not invited to a press screening because there was no press screening, and now we know why. But and yeah, if you like this show, please like and subscribe and all that good stuff. And yeah, until next time, whenever that is, whatever that is, thanks very much. Take care. And you've been trapped. No, that's stupid.
It's a trap.